owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia, and welcome to American Warrior Radio. Unfortunately, war amongst nations is not an anomaly. Mankind has been fighting since we first picked up a stick or a stone. Sometimes these conflicts are warranted and necessary. Often they are not. I don't know that I could name a good war, but I can name several that we should all be grateful were fought. Our brave young men and women sent to exercise societal-endorsed violence in order to preserve a greater good. World War II is probably the best example that comes to my mind. We can all learn lessons from these conflicts and from the stories of the individuals who fought them. The first thing that got me engaged with military history was a book about a special group of volunteers that fought during the Second World War. It's called 1,000 Destroyed, The Life and Times of the 4th Fighter Group by Grover Cleveland Hall. I was hooked. I've been a voracious reader ever since. I'm always looking to learn more, though. Hence, I recently streamed a series called Hitler's Last Stand. It's a collection of some of the battles waged toward the end of the war in Europe. I consider myself pretty well informed, but the series taught me that, boy, there's a whole lot I don't know. And I bet you might not either, like the completely bizarre story of the battle for Castle Itter. Stay tuned. Our guest today was one of the subject matter experts drawn upon to provide commentary for that series, and for good reason. He's appeared on the Military Channel, the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, the Smithsonian Network, CNN, Fox News, C-SPAN, just to name a few. He's written no fewer than 14 books, including one that I now know I have to get, U.S. Military History for Dummies. He's currently the Curator's Distinguished Professor of U.S. Military History at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Professor John C. McManus.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Do I have to call you Professor?
No, please call me John.
Okay, fair enough. So, John, you started as a sports journalist and a broadcaster, so I guess the transition to military history is perfectly natural. I mean, war is a team sport after all, I guess.
Well, it is, and in terms of what I do, it's not all that different than what I had learned as a journalism student, which is, you know, figuring out a story, analyzing the information, communicating it, you know, and of course, history is just sort of a larger perspective that you get over a longer period of time, and I do prefer that, you know, and I'm very pleased with my choice. But, yeah, a lot of the same skills certainly do apply.
Now, you know, I shared my story of what kind of got me hooked, and what caused you to make that transition, John, from sports to teaching and writing about history?
You know, I'm with you in the sense that, to me, World War II was such a kind of a seminal event that it was, you know, by the time I came along, it was always there. You know, the veterans and the effect, you know, that lingered for decades in the war and still does, I think. And what struck me, especially when I was a kid reading about it, is very few books seem to get at the heart of what the war, what battle or combat was like for those who actually fought it. It seemed like the actual real war, what went on, was quite distant. And so what really persuaded me to go in this direction as an historian was the fact that World War II is this important, and yet I didn't feel like we had a good enough feel, those of us who came along later, for what the war was like for those who fought it and what it cost them and the lessons we can learn from all that. So to me, that just seemed more consequential than sports. I mean, I still love sports, of course, and I think they're important too, but I just think there's a much larger, you know, a much larger kind of significance to understanding not just, of course, World War II, but I think it's the greatest conflict in human history. So it certainly affects us all these years later.
John, it's so nice to have such an expert like yourself on American Warrior Radio, so I'm going to be a little bit all over the place. There's a couple of specific stories that I'd like you to help tell, but I'm curious, you, given your remarks in the context of the world today, and very often when I talk about World War II or talk to some of the veterans, a perfect example is I'm done fighting the war in Europe, I'm not headed to the Pacific, but I've got some time to decompress, and then I'm on a ship with other people who've been through it, and we're, you know, sailing across the ocean before we end up back in Sheboygan. And, you know, the letters from home, you know, you'd be lucky if you got mail But nowadays, it's almost like the war is live streaming in our living rooms and on our laptops and on our cell phones just every day. Is that, do you sense, what is your sense as a historian of how that changes the context of how we see these stories?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, the war by the 21st century especially is much more immediate, and the transition from battle zone to home front for those who fight is just, you know, much more jarring. In World War II, you would have had that chance to decompress during the ship ride home or whatever, or maybe on occupation duty before you came home, and that stretched on for some for months and even a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so but if we're talking about, say, doing a tour of duty in Afghanistan or Iraq, it's the kind of situation where you could be, you know, deployed in theater one day, and then, you know, within a couple of 3 days, you're probably back at your home post. And certainly there was a lot of counseling and decompression attempts on the part of the armed forces. But the nature of it is just different when you have that kind of rapid, you know, transportation. Plus, as you mentioned, you can stay in closer touch with your family if you want to electronically. In World War II, you just simply didn't have that option. You were writing letters. And, you know, so in Vietnam, you see a little preview of this. There were phone banks that the armed forces set up at that time in which some soldiers who were on leave might have like a 15 to 20 minute conversation with people at home. So you're seeing the preview of what later, of course, by the 21st century becomes the ability to have that direct communication. I think in some ways, you know, it's better for family members, but also a little bit more worrisome because in World War II, you might not have really had much conception of the kind of dangers your loved one was facing. I was a bit out of sight, out of mind in that regard. You know, by 21st century wars, once you're talking to someone in person and sometimes even hearing a little bit of the background of what's going on during a phone conversation or, you know, Skyping or something like that, you do get a better sense of the dangers and the immediacy of it, too. And so in that sense, it really does affect the people at home who have loved ones deployed overseas, too.
You know, John, I recently had a guest on that wrote a book about our special forces in Afghanistan, and it made me think of that when you say that, because in this case, it was a Green Beret, and he was there doing stuff that we're not supposed to talk about. Well, you know, mom, baby girl runs into the kitchen and says, "Mom, Dad's on TV." And so she goes in there and sees her Green Beret husband and, you know, this news broadcast. And it's like, oh, okay, I knew he was there, but I didn't, yeah, kind of a jarring thing. John, the challenge that you and I both face, I believe, is particularly when it comes to the World War II and the Korean War generation, is just the practical reality is that there's fewer and fewer of those folks around. And I don't know about you, but I feel a certain, almost a desperation to tell these stories and to get them recorded. Do you feel the same way? And do you notice any difference between the willingness of the World War II veterans to tell their story compared to Vietnam era veterans compared to current day veterans?
You know, by the time that I came along, you know, maybe by the 1990s, getting stories from people of all eras, I didn't really notice that kind of difference. I suppose maybe if I'd been at it in the 70s, maybe the early 80s, you have a greater reluctance on the part of Vietnam veterans, and maybe still some World War II veterans, because some of the memories might have been a little too fresh. And sometimes it takes a few decades maybe to start to tell the story or come to terms with it. For me personally, not that really this matters all that much, but I would say for me personally, I've been in a sort of a sad state of denial in the last 5+ years as we lose so many World War II veterans and many Korean War veterans too, quite a few of whom were my friends, that I it's very difficult to come face to face with the reality of time passing and a lot of these folks being gone. And I certainly share, you know, your notion that we should preserve as many of these stories as possible. I would also say too, that sometimes the stories have a shelf life in that occasionally when veterans get so old, it's just difficult for them to remember, mm-hmm. or it's been whitewashed through decades of whatever they've read or heard from other people or whatever. So the story becomes perishable, and that only adds in a way to my sense of melancholy about it, to be honest with you.
John, we need to take a break real quick, but I tell you, when we were doing the pre-interview, I mentioned this particular battle during the war in Europe, and I thought it was news to me, and then you pretty much informed me that I must be the only living creature out there who's never heard of it. But I do want you to share it with our listeners when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, we'll be talking about the Battle of Castle Itter. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking World War II history with John McManus. You can learn more, visit johncmcmanus.com, McManus. John has published no fewer than 14 books. We'll talk a little bit about his most recent book. But, John, let's jump in the Wayback Machine and go to May 5th, 1945. This is, and again, I'm embarrassed that I didn't know about this, but... Maybe I won't be the only one. This is something out of a Twilight Zone episode or maybe a comic book. Castle Itter.
Yeah, the crazy situation in which you have this incredible, venerable castle, which is also like a built-in fortification. And it's been used by the Nazis to incarcerate some like high-level political VIP prisoners, mainly from France. So that meant former French prime ministers, people high up in what had been, the French government before the Germans conquered France. There's a French tennis star there. And so there's a lot of concern among these folks and even among some of their German guards at the end of the war that the SS is going to come in and just slaughter them before the German surrender. And so this begins to kind of coalesce with the approach of the U.S. Army, most notably the 12th Armored Division. And you have this this colorful company commander, an armored commander by the name of Captain Jack Lee, who's just straight out of central casting, in terms of like a flamboyant tanker. And he becomes the sort of main link of the unit that's supposed to go there and help liberate this castle. And you have a subplot, and it's a major one, of actual SS guys, a couple of SS guys who apparently have a conscience and don't necessarily want to see these prisoners slaughtered, to eventually work with the Americans in order to fend off some of their comrades. And so this all climaxes in a battle fought by a combination of these sort of turned SS guys, the U.S. Army soldiers under Captain Lee, and the prisoners, some of them themselves, against soldiers from the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, who, of course, knew nothing about any of this. They just knew they wanted to go and reclaim the castle and maybe take down those VIP prisoners. So it really is like something out of a movie, but it actually happened in real life.
Now, keep in mind, in context, we're talking when this conflict was enjoined. This, we're talking, what, like maybe 5 days, a week after Hitler had committed suicide. Pretty much most of the members of the German military probably figured out this was over, but there were some diehard, hardcore folks that were sort of retreating back up into the mountains, particularly areas around the Castle Itter that were just, and I think one of the quotes was, they knew they'd lost the war, but they were going to take as many Americans with them or other folks with them before they were killed themselves, kind of a situation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Nazism was a commitment for them and, an end-of-life commitment for some of them who were determined to go down fighting and take as many Allied soldiers and other perceived enemies as they possibly could. And you're right. Hitler had committed suicide 5 days earlier, so Germany's in flux. It's enormously chaotic. And I should point out, too, I think that maybe this makes the Castle Itter situation a little more interesting in the sense that all this is happening in the context of a serious concern on the part of the Allied command from Eisenhower on down, that you're going to have unrepentant, hardcore Nazis take to the mountains of Austria and southern Germany and continue to fight on for years as guerrillas. They were often called werewolves by the Allies. And so So what's happening at Castle Itter is playing out sort of in that context. And you can see, some of these either everyday German soldiers or even some SS guys whose hands are not really that dirty in terms of war crimes or anything, beginning to kind of see the reality and turn And then you have the other guys who are unreconciled. And the Americans kind of in the middle of this, and then these French VIPs, who, by the way, many of whom hated each other with a passion because they were political enemies back home. So you also have that little context and subplot as well. So it's a really interesting study in in human differences and how enemies can be brought together in certain crises and, you know, how this can play out. So it really is a kind of fascinating chapter.
And just to clarify again, so we have a situation where we've got Nazis, some of whom are SS, not exactly the Boy Scouts of Hitler's army, fighting alongside U.S. soldiers under the command of Jack Lee was what, a lieutenant?
I think maybe he's a captain at that point.
Okay.
But, you know, like he's a company grade officer, a junior officer. Right. So exactly. So they're fighting under his command. One of them was an SS major.
Right. So
coordinating with Captain Lee.
Yeah. So I mean, the Nazi officers outrank him technically. But so it's just this bizarre, and I encourage folks, you know, the visual is, you know, seeing the Germans with the grease guns next to a tanker with his, you know, Tommy gun fighting off other Germans. It's just it's almost too bizarre to be real, but it actually happened.
It actually did. And the other thing, too, that's almost like out of a movie is, you know, the longer this battle goes on, the more it's advantageous to the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier units that just have more heavy weapons and more people and have besieged the castle. But you also have infantrymen from the U.S. Army's 36th Infantry Division, Texas National Guard, that are pressing forward toward the castle, too. And they kind of get there at the nick of time before, you know, these sort of hardcore SS guys can really get in there and slaughter everybody in the castle. So it's sort of in the nick of time in that sense, too.
I can't help but think that it was either a crazy or courageous or both move on the part of Jack Lee, because he gets up to this castle with not very many men. I think he got one tank through that they placed to guard the entrance. But he did not know initially when the shooting started whether these Germans were going to shoot at their former comrades or shoot him in the back.
For sure. There's a leap of faith there, exactly. But, I mean, the way you put it is it's perfect. I mean, it's crazy and courageous, and a lot of times that's true no matter what battle we're talking about. And in this case, you really couldn't have picked a better suited individual for this kind of mission because of his acumen in armored warfare and how he was going to use his tanks, and he understood mobility and how to move his people along the roads and get to a place quickly. But also just, I think, the kind of personality – a kind of devil-may-care sort of personality to take on this kind of mission and really embrace it.
Well, and also some of the captives were, I think at least two of them were former French generals who had seen combat in the First World War, and he's telling them what to do.
Right, exactly. Like Maxime Weygand and Maurice Gamelin, exactly right. And you also have General de Gaulle's sister there, you know, de Gaulle, the leader of the Free French, and so you've got them represented too. And he's telling these senior French commanders, you know, what's what. And so you have to have a little bit of confidence in Flagger to do that, I would guess.
Now, they were in a castle, but they were heavily outnumbered. They didn't have the heavy weapons that the attacking Germans had. I mean, pretty much they just had rifles and sidearms after the tank got knocked out. But there were – what's amazing to me about this story as well, John, is there was only one person killed in action, and that was a German.
Yeah, right. It was it was one of the two German officers who were helping. It was either Major Gangl. I think it was Major Gangl. Yeah. But they could have had much worse casualties because you're right. They're just mainly they got rifles and they got submachine guns to fight off a force that's got heavier weapons. It'd be a short fight.
And basically he lost his life protecting one of the French prisoners.
Yeah, exactly. So he had committed to protecting these VIPs. These French prisoners, and he loses his life over it. It's really quite interesting because, you know, we're conditioned to think, and I think with good reason, SS equals perpetrator. In this case, this is someone who really isn't that way. And he had had to really kind of, in the run-up to this whole, the climactic event of the castle, there's a couple of weeks that run up to this, and there's a great deal of tension, and intriguing that goes on among the various parties, and he had had to kind of play it both ways in order even to get in that position of trying to protect the prisoners, which was quite altruistic on his part, too. But he also, I think, we might point out, hoped to rehabilitate himself and his reputation post-war. So there was some level of self-interest, but I don't know that you could say enough to lay down his life the way he did.
So, John, if I was picking my team to defend a castle against overwhelming odds, I don't think I would have picked a French tennis star for that group. But he worked out okay, didn't he?
He was amazing. His name is Jean Barotra, and he was in tremendous physical condition. And so he plays a major role in, you know, leaving the castle to go and make contact with the Americans. And, yeah, he's a guy who plays a central role in this whole thing. And you think, well, tennis player. But actually, he performs more like a very courageous soldier. He's really one of the most remarkable figures in this whole thing.
Well, hopefully they'll make a full movie out of it someday, John. Do you know of any other occasion in at least World War II history where this sort of a situation took place?
Boy, I can't think of one off the top of my head. I guess if we really combed around, we might find some circumstance, because I suppose these other kinds of situations could replicate a little bit. But no, I know of nothing quite like this.
Well, John, we come back. I want to talk about another castle siege, which just seems odd given it's World War II, but I found it fascinating as well. So, Hold that thought. Hey, folks, I know most of our listeners are military and first responders, so you're familiar with the tradition of challenge coins. Let me introduce you to my friends at BossCoins.com. Their artists helped me design my coins. They went from design to in my pocket in only 2 weeks later, and the coin is beautiful. I love it. It really pops on the copper base. If you're thinking about a challenge coin or need to reorder your current one, please consider my friends at BossCoins.com. I'll even sweeten the deal. Send me an email, bbg@AmericanWarriorRadio.com. I'll personally introduce you to one of the bosses at Boss Custom Coins, who'll give you a special American Warrior Radio listener discount. You'll love your Boss Custom Coin, too. Get started at BossCoins.com, and don't forget to shoot me an email, bbg@AmericanWarriorRadio.com, to get your special discount. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Professor John McManus. You can learn more at johncmcmanus.com. That's M-C-M-A-N-U-S. He's got a number of great books out. I want to talk a little bit about some of those, John, too, but also want to touch on one more of the series from Hitler's Last Stand that I found fascinating, because kind of maintaining the castle theme, there was Fort Montbray, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, September 13th, 1944. This was a fort in the overlooking, I guess, the French town of Brest. And tell me why that was, capturing this fort was so critically important from a strategic standpoint.
Yeah, so the French have, of course, by then, a long tradition of being premier military engineers and protecting some of their key cities and frontier areas with superbly constructed fortifications and castle and battlements. Fort Montbray had been there a long time to protect the major port city of Brest, which the Allies want because by September 1944, they're running into serious supply problems as they break out of Normandy and advance toward Germany. They need as many harbors as they can get. Soldiers from the 29th Infantry Division had been given this assignment. There were also Rangers involved, but for this particular attack on Fort Montbray, they're given the assignment of taking the fort, which in some respects is the key then to taking the harbor as well. So that's the significance of it.
And I want to emphasize, because this plays into the story, this fort was, they began construction in 1777. Like a lot of stuff back then, it took a little while to complete. But we're talking basically a kind of an almost medieval fort, and versus crocodile tanks, artillery, air bombardment. You would think this would be a pretty easy thing to conquer, but it sure wasn't.
It wasn't, because it's, the fortifications they've constructed in the 18th century are so substantial that you might as well be dealing with thick concrete reinforced walls and battlements of some kind with major pillboxes and bunkers. Plus, you add to that modern weaponry such as modern mines, and the Germans were very good mine sowers, and you know, did this in copious quantities upon every approach to the fort. And the other thing too, the terrain around the fort tended to be pretty flat. That's why it is where it is, because it can command almost any avenue of approach into the inner harbor area. So that means that it's going to be very difficult to get near enough in order to breach those walls and to begin to take over portions of the fort as you need to do that. And so this is a very kind of torturous incremental process for the 29th Division, just to get close enough to within striking distance of the fortifications.
And if folks aren't familiar with the Crocodile Tank, that is basically a flamethrower on wheels, a very fearsome psychological weapon, but doesn't do much against stone. They put a, you know, threw a tank destroyer up there just lobbing shells at this front gate, bang, 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 I don't know, 50 shells, didn't really do much. So at some point, the commander of that action is like, okay, what do I need to do? And in comes Captain Sidney Smith, and part of the reason I love this story was, I mean, this guy put combat in combat engineers. And literally, they're clearing mines, they're working with picks and shovels under intense enemy fire, and still getting the job done. Just amazing heroism.
Oh, it really is, and innovation, too. Because Smith and his engineers are just kind of improvising under fire and doing what needs to be done. So, yeah, I mean, of course, mine clearing, that's probably what they're going to be doing anyway as engineers, but they're also they're coordinating with smoke missions, smoke shell missions, to provide them some level of concealment. They eventually, of course, are going to be instrumental in setting the explosive charges that will help breach, you know, an opening in Fort Montpareil, in tandem, of course, with the artillery. And the artillery is a key component of this, too, that you see the Americans bring up, 105-millimeter artillery piece, just batter this place. And in a way, that's kind of a preview of what you're going to see the next month in the Battle of Aachen, in an urban setting in which, again, you're running into like modern constructed buildings that are resistant to a lot of your firepower, and you're having to kind of innovate right under pressure. And so you're really – The Americans had learned in Normandy that combined arms was the key to success and survival with dealing with the hedgerows. And so here again, in dealing with Montpareil, which is such a great obstacle, now we've got to coordinate with the engineers, with artillery, and then we've got to move our infantrymen close enough that they're going to be able to exploit the breach whenever you do get that, in order to begin to clear out the Germans inside the fort. And then, of course, that's a big part of the battle, too.
And that's what kind of made me chuckle, John, is, you know, artillery and tanks are quite a bit more advanced than a trebuchet. But at the end of the day, the tactic that worked in getting into this fort was the same thing. You know, how do you conquer a medieval castle? Well, you use medieval tactics. And basically they found a place where they could tunnel in up under the wall and basically just blow the wall to collapse it so they could get in. That made me chuckle a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, it was old school in that regard. But it's also set up by this kind of incremental battle in which you're getting through the mines well enough to get in position to tunnel under and set those explosive charges. Plus, you need the security that the infantry have provided in clearing out of the areas and suppressing German fire, and, of course, the armor, too. You know, you mentioned the flame tanks, and the flame tanks really do play a crucial role in the whole battle. The British tankers were extraordinarily valorous. Their contribution is more in the approach to Fort Montpareil, because you put it very well, of course, that, you know, flame's a terrifying weapon, but it's not going to do much against this kind of stone, you know, stone construction. So, you know, at that point, it just becomes more of a psychological weapon, the Crocodile tanks.
You know, I want to get into some of your more recent work, John, but one thing that also I don't want to overlook recognizing Lieutenant Kelton. And there's one of my favorite scenes from Kelly's Heroes is, you know, the general's listening to the radio traffic and he says something like, they've even, you know, they've got the grave registration guys going, this is the guy I want. He's gotten everybody involved in it. And in this case, Lieutenant Kelton really was quite a hero with the grave registration unit. Went out there to retrieve the remains of a soldier under intense fire to make sure that he didn't get blown up when they blew up the wall. So quite a story there.
Yeah, because the body had been lying there, and yeah, as you said, when they're so when the Americans are setting the charges, they're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this poor guy who's just been killed in action, his remains are going to be atomized and we'll never recover him. So it took a great deal of courage for Lieutenant Kelton to go out there under duress and to retrieve that body, which isn't easy to do under any circumstances, much less that kind of situation.
John, I want to talk about your latest work called Island Infernos, and this is well, there's lots of great stuff going on in this book, and a couple of takeaways that I got from it that, again, reflecting back in hindsight is really fascinating. One of the main ones, though, was, and this principally deals with the United States Army, and we're going from the European theater to the Pacific theater now, and the politics, I guess, for lack of a better word, and General MacArthur, you know, kind of a compare and contrast, General MacArthur versus General Eisenhower. MacArthur was, I guess maybe history has been a little too kind to him, maybe.
In some respects, it has. I mean, certainly MacArthur had some good qualities. Obviously, he was very, very bright. He was a fine strategist. He had reservoirs of personal courage. Of course, he'd been a highly decorated soldier in World War I. And I would venture to say that among American theater commanders in World War II, he sees more action and faces more, you know, personal danger than any of them by a long shot. And he tended to be cordial and courteous in his dealings with people, but there was another really kind of a darker side to him, quite egomaniacal, vainglorious, Byzantine in his schemings, disingenuous, and I think a bit overrated in terms of some of his battles and some of the monumental screw-ups that he presides over. And I kind of chronicle this in the series that I'm doing in the Army in the Pacific. But one of his lesser attractive qualities is that he really wanted to take most all the credit for himself. And he really has this kind of cult of personality around him. And he's actively, at the end of 1943, actively running for president while on active duty as a theater commander. And I personally, I find that very troubling. And, you know, I think it's fortunate that it didn't go very far. But I think it's a kind of a cautionary tale.
Well, and a little bit ironic that Eisenhower ended up being president, but... Yeah,
it is. And, you know, the other thing, if I could interject for 1 minute, of course, many realists may know that Eisenhower once worked for MacArthur as an aide for about 6 years and had eventually left MacArthur's retinue because he just could not stand working for him anymore. And he kind of wanted to go out on his own, of course, understandably. And so, yeah, I mean, Eisenhower becomes president and MacArthur, of course, deeply, deeply resented that and was quite jealous of him.
You know, one of the greatest honors of my life, John, I had the opportunity to serve as an honorary commander for what was then a 3-star general. And one of the things that impressed me about his leadership was he was a true servant leader. He had absolutely no qualms about, you know, giving credit where credit was due. And MacArthur, in fact, I guess there's a segment of your book that talks about where some of the soldiers came in to actually complain to him about his PR team and how folks weren't getting enough credit. And, I mean, just kind of literally, okay, battle's over. You know, we're announcing victory. But meanwhile, there's soldiers out there and Marines and sailors still dying in mop-up operations. But he couldn't be bothered with that. He wanted to get the press to, you know, chalk another one up and move on.
Yeah, that's what I mean by the sort of vaingloriousness. And absolutely, that term mopping up, which, you know, to you and me in the middle of a battle, our lives are in danger. And so we don't want that kind of janitorial term to what we're doing. And yet he would just sort of announce early that a battle was over when it really wasn't. It's like, well, that's news to the Japanese. Someone forgot to tell them. You know, you see this time and again throughout the Pacific War, the tendency to take all the credit for himself and to kind of hog the limelight. And the best example of that in some ways is that he has under his command throughout from 1942 to 45, what I consider to be probably the finest American ground commander in the war, whom most of us have never heard of, Lieutenant General Robert Eichelberger, who wins key battles for him from Buna in New Guinea in 1942 all the way to the Philippines in the summer of 1945. And yet isn't all that well known, and in part because MacArthur really seemed to want it that way.
John, we come back. I want to talk more. One of the real revealing things to me about your latest work, Island Infernos, is just the logistics and the distinction, again, comparing and contrasting the war in Europe to the Pacific and how different that was. They say an army marches on its stomach. Well, it couldn't be more true in this case. And folks, when we come back, one other little tip for you. If you're going to leave some critical intelligence in a swamp, make sure it sinks. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler Garcia. We're talking World War II with John McManus. You can learn more at johncmcmanus.com, M-C-M-A-N-U-S. Just a very outstanding expert on World War II history. Lots of books out there. John, your latest work, Island Infernos. And I guess, you know, I didn't know about Castle Itter. You educated me. And I guess you're supposed to do that. You're a professor, after all. Right? That's your job.
That's right.
Something else I learned from your latest work, though, is I guess this maybe falls in the category of it's better to be lucky than good, but this situation that really was a key for the rest of the Pacific theater, some retreating Japanese decided that it's too heavy. We're just going to leave this chest here in the swamp and hope the Americans don't find it.
Yeah, so that was in New Guinea. And, yeah, so the Japanese, of course, are getting degraded by the conditions, and it's very difficult for the Allies to operate there, too. So, but the way this thing had played out by 1944 is the Japanese were in retreat but still formidable on this massive island, New Guinea. And so as this Japanese formation is retreating, they're ditching gear. And one of the things that's in that metal box was a key code book to many of the Imperial Army's, communication codes. And it just happens that an Australian patrol finds it, and they retrieve the code book, and the Allies had microwave technology to kind of dry it out and to eventually read it. And this becomes just this sort of like the Rosetta Stone, for unlocking Japanese communications for about the next 9 months or so. And the other thing that's just confounding from a Japanese point of view, the officer who was responsible for that code book disingenuously told his superiors that he had actually destroyed it, when, of course, he hadn't. So they were under the impression their codes were secure when they weren't. And the consequence of this is that MacArthur then knew the disposition of their forces along the northern coast of New Guinea. And so he's able to conceive of an excellent and bold amphibious operation to invade Hollandia in April 1944 to outflank the Japanese, to greatly accelerate the pace of the Allied timetable. And, of course, as you probably know, he wants to get back to the Philippines. And so it accelerates that timetable as well. And it's just a sort of disaster on many levels for the Japanese. And Eichelberger, by the way, is the one who commands that invasion and then sets up a massive logistical base there that is so important for the future of the war. So, yeah, that just had implications on many levels. But what's interesting, too, from a point of view of an historian, for about 30 or 40, even 50 years after World War II, we didn't really know about this. And so we just figured, well, MacArthur just had this bold masterstroke. It's incredible, this stroke of genius. Well, it was certainly a great thing he did, but he had a lot of good intel that helped him along the way, and this is the classic example.
John, I'm in the public relations and communication business, and good PR is great to have. In retrospect, the Navy, the Marines, great PR. A lot of folks, when we think about the war in the Pacific, the Marines, of course, come to mind, and then, of course, the role of the Navy. But the Army's role there is greatly overlooked.
It is, and so that's why I did this series. And it ends up, the Army's role there is so vast, such an incredible story, that it's ending up as a trilogy, my trilogy on the Army in the Pacific. This is, 1.8 million American ground soldiers served in the war against Japan. That's the third largest army we've ever sent overseas to fight a war. And, of course, one glance at a map of the Pacific shows you that this is a naval war, and you're dependent upon sea power on both sides, of course. No one would dispute that. But in the end, islands had to be taken, had to be secured, and, of course, logistics had to be done. And so, you know, in this series, I want to make it, always want to make it very clear, I'm not really seeking to denigrate the Marine Corps. Quite the contrary. It just shows the remarkable valor and contributions of the Marine Corps that only six divisions did as much as they did, but the Army had four times that many divisions deployed throughout the Pacific War, and plays a leading role from the combat side to the intel side, to the logistical side, to civil affairs. I mean, you name it, the Army is really heavily involved with it, and it kind of is the precursor for much of what we've dealt with ever since in the wars we've fought.
John, Ben's dumb question of the show, how many of the soldiers or personnel that served in Europe then went and fought in the Pacific as well? Was that a relatively small percentage?
It is a relatively small percentage, and I don't have like the number or the actual percentage point off the top of my head, but it is a real minority. You have some cross-pollination, you know, among commanders. A really good example is a commander who I discussed in the first book in this series, Fire and Fortitude, and his name was Alexander Patch, and he commanded the Allied forces at Guadalcanal from about the end of 1942 into the early months of 1943, most of which were Army forces that basically knock out the Japanese presence on Guadalcanal. And then he became an Army commander of the 7th Army in Europe, that led the Battle of Invasion of South France and so on and so forth. So you do see some of that. I would say more likely among those who would have served in both theaters, they tended to be Navy, because ships might be in one part of the Battle of the Atlantic or the invasion of Normandy, and then 8 months later, they're in a Pacific invasion sometimes. You do see a few people who were, you know, in on the end of the war in Europe that are going to be redeployed with the thinking of that they're going to be needed in the invasion of Japan. But, you know, fortunately, that never happened. So some of them had been redeployed in theater, but, of course, very few had seen combat by that time.
John, we're down to just about a minute. You and I both believe in the importance of telling these stories and communicating them before those who can tell their own stories or have long disappeared. If you, this may not be a fair question, but what would be the one story or two stories from that World War II era that you think still need to be told, that haven't been told?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this is a story that hasn't been told, but I don't think we can study Omaha Beach enough. When you see this idea of like citizen soldiers improvising under fire, under tremendously challenging circumstances. And the one individual I often point to is a guy named Lieutenant Jimmy Monteith, who had once attended Virginia Tech, and ends up as a really leading figure for the 1st Infantry Division on Omaha Beach on D-Day, and it cost him his life, you know. So I think all of us understand the magnitude of the Normandy invasion, and I think it's also interesting just to see at the very micro individual level how the actions of one person can make a big difference for such an important moment in history.
Professor, thanks for spending your time with us this weekend on American Warrior Radio. We truly appreciate it.
It's been a great time, Ben. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Folks, visit johncmcmanus.com, MCMANUS.com, to learn more. You've got great books. Get his books. Read them. I found the one I've touched so far at least fascinating. I'm going to get more, John. So you sold some more books here today.
It's always a good thing. Thank you so much.
Of course. Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast and over 300 others can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can find us on your favorite streaming platform. We're on Apple. We're on Google. We're on Spotify. We're on Pandora. We're on I got to stop. We're everywhere. Please, though, the point is, listen to these stories and please share them, because it's so important that they never be forgotten. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.